Please welcome to this Delta Learning Exchange. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Nell Myhan. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Welcome to the Delta Learning Exchange. We're here today with Tom Wolfe. He's going to be presenting on creating a legacy, successfully sustaining your efforts. And I want to say that I'm also here with my colleague, David Lee. Welcome, David.
Hi there, and hi, everyone. We've got a small yet hopefully a really great group. I'd love to just and if someone is on the phone only, if you can just press star 1 and say hello so we can know who's here on the phone only. So if you're on the phone only, just press star 1, and then the operator will know that you are here. So, operator, is there anyone who has pressed star 1?
No, sir. No one has signal.
Okay. In that case, I think all of you are on here, and so just want to be able to welcome you to this. If you're familiar with Prevent Connect, and you, what I'm going to do is just say click yes in the feedback box. If you are familiar, and if you're not familiar, say no, and if you have no answer, it looks like all of you are familiar who are answering. I'll share those. So thank you. That's great. I won't need to explain a whole lot about us. We have web conferences, reading clubs, which are smaller discussions around articles. We have a prevention wiki. We have podcasts where you can hear voices around the issues of domestic violence and sexual violence prevention. We have some e-learning units. Do follow us on Twitter. That's a great way to be able to get some information around this issue. We have our blog. You can always join us on Facebook and our email group, and in addition to some of our newsletters. And if you need to contact us, you'll see the information for the Prevent Connect team with Nell, myself, and Chad. So with no further ado, I'm going to hand it back to you, Nell.
Great. So I want to just say a few things about this technology. I know that folks are familiar, so you know how to raise your hand. So I'd like to ask all of you to raise your hand so that we can see that you are familiar. And I see that Katia, Julia, it looks like we have all of our hands up. I'll put your hands down now. This is a way for us to be able to get information from you and feedback. The next thing I want to point out is that there is a question and answer feature, which is right under the list of participants. So we'll be offering you some chances to let us know what you think, basically. So that's a feedback system as well. There's also, just below that, the text chat. And we've already begun the text chat, so many of you, I'm sure, can see that, you know, that's a way that you can, we'll be including your voice. And the presentation is in the format of PowerPoint slides. If you have any technical problems, you can reach the iLink support at 800-799-4510. And also, we're available at CalCASA at 888-922-5227 if you have any problems. At this time, I'd like to welcome Tom Wolfe. He's going to be offering us his wisdom on creating a legacy, successfully sustaining your efforts. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. Good to be here. I'm delighted to be working with you. I've done quite a bit of work over the years on issues of domestic violence, family violence, child abuse, child sexual assault prevention, and have worked with the CDC and some of the national coalitions through them, and have done a lot of work on sustaining efforts. And let me say a couple of introductory words, and I want to turn to you and find out who's here and what your interests are. I started getting interested in sustainability when working earlier. Someone asked me to be a consultant and to come into their community and help them look at sustaining their program. And when I got there, it became clear they'd had a $400,000 grant for 3 years. It was 2 months before everything was up, and they wanted me to help them figure out how they were going to sustain their effort. And I didn't do really well at that because it's not easy to do it at that 11th hour. And it happened one more time, and then after that I stopped accepting those efforts, and I started to invitations and started to read the literature on sustainability, which was very thin. if you go to look at the literature, it's really about how do you find the money. And I thought, boy, if that's the only thing we're doing, we're in trouble here. So I created a way of looking at sustainability that involved a four-pronged approach that we'll talk about as we move on. And a little bit later, a couple of years later, we put that into a tip sheet and sent it around in our newsletter. And the newsletters had a way of sort of just being copied by one coalition group and passed on to another. And I got invited to go to California to the Sierra Health Foundation, where they had a series of children's health coalitions. And this was the end of their three-year effort. And I found out that when they came asked me to come and give a keynote at the final meetings, that they had actually used my tip sheet and converted it into questions that they asked the coalitions every year they're in existence, starting from year one. And the questions were, how have you been planning for sustainability in these four areas? And it's so interesting to see them at the end of 3 years, how they had so much success in coalitions that are actually going to continue after the money disappeared. So I thought, well, there may be even more to this than I thought. So I've been doing a lot of work on helping people think through sustainability of their programs, whether it has to do with money or just getting their programs institutionalized in the community or building community support or changing policy. So that's the frame for today. And maybe we could just start by having people say who they are and, you know, what's interesting about this topic. We're only five people, so we can really hear a word or two from you. And just to clarify the technology here, David and Nell, do they just speak or do they write into the chat room? How do they do this?
Well, let's get people's voices because we've got so few people here. So I'm going to ask the operator to open up Jessica's phone line. And are you able to do that?
She would need to press star one, and then I can open her line.
There's so few people here, I'm going to ask. So, Jessica, can you press star one, and then we can just get a chance to hear a couple words from you about what you do. And has this happened?
Yeah, she just signaled. Give me one moment. And, Jessica, your line is open.
Okay.
Hi, Jessica. I know that's not what you look like.
No, that is not what I look like.
But we'll encourage you, if you're in continuing learning exchange, send a picture in so we can know who you are.
Okay.
Or at least send a picture of your logo of your agency. So, hi. So what organization are you from?
I'm in Winchester, Virginia, from the Virginia Delta team. We are the Laurel Center is our organization name.
Great. And, Tom, what's the question?
What's your interest in issues of sustainability? What are your concerns?
We've been lucky to get people on board, but then keeping them there has been an issue for us.
Sustaining members.
Yes.
Yeah, great.
With our Delta team and with our project, because we'll have this great project and we'll be ready to go, and they'll be great, and then things kind of slow down, and we lose everybody.
Terrific. Great. Hey, who's next?
So let's next go to Julie. Julie Anderson, can you go ahead and press star one on your phone so we can unmute your phone? And hopefully, let's see if Julie has a similar picture to Jessica. I'll put my picture up for the time being. Hi.
Hi
there, Julie.
Hi,
this is Julie. I'm Julie Anderson. I work for the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence. We're based in Madison, Wisconsin. I also, like Jessica, work for the Delta Project. I share my position with Susan Ramspacker, who's been involved with Delta since it started here at Wakabi, but I've just been here for a year. And my interest in sustainability, well, I think, you know, I've worked with very small nonprofits before, and you know, funding is always an issue for any type of sustainability, so it's interesting to hear, like, what are options beyond relying on large grants, but also, as Jessica mentioned, how do we maintain, beyond just individuals, how do we maintain sustaining work that goes beyond the individuals that are immediately involved, but institutionalizing the work so that it is integrated into the organizations that are part of it.
Yeah.
Great. Great, great questions.
Great. Thank you very much. Is it Katya? I might be mispronouncing your first name. If you can press star 1, Katya, so we can open up and hear from you.
And did Julie and Jessica stay on as we do this?
No, I can only have one line
open. Okay.
So, Katya, have you pressed star 1?
And my line is open.
Hi, Katya. Hello? Your phone might be on mute locally if you... So unmute your phone local on your own phone if you're trying to join us, because we can't hear you yet. Hello? Her line is open, but yet we cannot hear you. Oh, are you there now?
No.
In that case, we're going to move on to Sarah, and I believe Sarah actually put a picture in. Yay, Sarah. So, Sarah, can you press star 1?
Great.
Sarah's from in for our 73 and sunny in Rhode Island. Hi, Sarah. Press star 1 so you can join the conversation.
And Sarah, your line is open.
Hi. Yeah, as you said, I'm from Rhode Island, and it is very sunny here today. I am the coordinator of one of our local Delta sites, and my interest in sustainability, you know, really comes from working with them. I'm fairly new at the Delta project, and I'm just looking to have more tools and, you know, find ways to continue the sustainability work that my predecessors have done. Because, you know, we have worked on helping connect people in the community to each other so that if our funding went away, they would still have those connections with one another. But we also want to make sure that we are keeping individual people on board and kind of building excitement about what we're doing. So,
great. So sustaining members and also multiple ways of doing sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Okay. So, David?
Yes.
Katya had technical difficulties, but I think she's back now.
Great.
Okay, Katya, I know you're trying to reach us. I got your chat. So, star 1.
And her line has been reopened.
Okay, thank you.
Hello?
Hello, Katya?
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, we're having minor difficulties. We had different phones on, and we're thinking that may have played a little part in our issue. Yeah, we are over. We actually have a couple of people on the line. We've got Ashley Strobel and Allison Smith-Estelle over here at the Domestic and Sexual Violence Services of Carbon County. We're out in Montana. I think we have similar sustainability issues, trying to institutionalize, try to stay within our schools and getting past us, I guess, and then building relationships with our schools.
Mm-hmm. So mainly focused on the schools.
We do a lot more focus on the schools, yes.
Uh-huh.
The prevention work within our schools.
Great. Terrific.
Okay, and I think Deborah, let's see, I wonder if you're ready to put your thoughts in?
I think Deborah said she's just going to be on VoIP. She's excited about this new technology, so she's not on the phone, but she did add...
She had her question,
so let's go ahead and click Debbie's picture. And Debbie is from Kansas. And she can...
Okay. Great.
Deborah, she said she's using VOLP but wanted to add her question. Are there characteristics of communities or organizations that indicate a readiness or place further in a process, making them better prepared to address sustainability?
Right, so the issue of community readiness. Terrific. So let's start, and I'll start going through this. I've noted a couple of things that I wasn't going to cover, and I'll make sure, because I've heard it from you, that we make sure to do that. So let me start by asking you some of the things. Can I get the next slide? Some of the things that about your beliefs about sustainability. This exercise I called Stand and Declare, because I usually do it in a room, and I put up the signs you see on the left, strongly agree, agree, disagree, strongly disagree, around the room, and no answer is actually neutral. And what we do is have people go to those corners, but we don't need to do that here because we have the magic box on the left. So let's go to the next slide, and here's the first question. Our team is too busy with its present agenda to spend more than a small amount of time thinking and planning for sustainability. Do you strongly agree, disagree, strongly disagree, or are you neutral on it? So put your marker in the place, and then we'll talk about why you chose that. We got an agree and four disagrees. I think that's the five. We have five voters, right? Great, terrific.
Share the results.
They're the results. So maybe some of the people who are in the disagree category could put it. Is it easiest to have them put it in the chat or to raise their hand? What works better?
Pardon?
Better for them.
If you have a comment, you can raise your hand or you can text chat, whatever your preference.
Yeah, whatever your preference is. If you hit star one, then you'll get put in for voice. And if you just want to text chat, why did four people disagree with the statement? The team is too busy with its present agenda to spend more than a small amount of time thinking and planning for sustainability. You disagree with it, so that. Can I hear from you? Can you chat in? And often people disagree because, in fact, they are planning for sustainability. Or no responses, huh? How about the agree? Person who agrees. Anybody want to comment on why you chose where you were? Okay, here we go. Julie.
Now they're coming in.
Okay, here we go. I have to get used to the pace on this, so I'll be more patient. Sustainability should be integrated into work as a regular part of what we're doing. I would agree with that. I'm interested in the word should, in the sense of, is that what we should do or is that what we actually do do? So that's an interesting.
That's interesting how Katya talks about having someone dedicated to work on sustainability.
That's terrific. That's very rare. That's a terrific idea. And so you're saying it needs, both Sarah and Julie say it needs to always be a part of our present agenda. Does that mean it actually is, that you, like Katya, actually have to and spend and commit the time to it? And Deborah says, I think this is the way it should be because some of the processes we're using make it difficult to focus, enough to focus. I would have preferred a process that would have integrated it at every single step, right? So it tends to be something that often escapes the agenda, but it sounds like this group of people have really focused on it, so that's terrific. And we have to just be clear about it. I don't think anybody would agree with what should be the case, but Sarah says it's part of their ongoing planning. That's terrific. Okay, great.
Of course,
so let's go to
somewhat a self-selecting group because these are the people that showed up for a workshop, a web conference on sustainability.
Right. So let's go on to the next slide. And again, I think that we believe may be a little distorting to this. The question is, what's going to happen in your community? Community institutions will welcome taking over our programs when our funding runs out.
So we're asking again if you would say if you agree with that or you disagree with that,
right.
Strongly or
yeah.
Mildly.
Here come the votes. The votes are coming in.
Disagree. Some agree. Mostly folks are disagreeing with that.
Yeah. So, again, let's hear a little bit about, why do you think it is that your community institutions will not welcome taking over your programs when your funding runs out? And I know
the question. So why would they not welcome them? That's,
yeah.
I think there's many reasons that communities aren't ready to just say, "Oh, we want to do this."
Yeah.
Or we're ready to do this, which is different than want to.
So the teachers, not enough time for teachers to do both our material and theirs. And that's a huge issue all the time when we're talking about, our curriculum, and then we go to the schools, and there are a million people banging on their doors saying, we want to get in. Deborah says, I think some would like to, but their own capacity and resources are stretched thin. Limited resources, the idea that there is an agency dedicated to domestic violence prevention. So you're the guys who are supposed to do this. You do it. And there are no allies, there are no resources. Now, we had one agree. And what was the – here comes Sarah.
So Sarah agrees because the program – running does not financially depend on them. They coordinate things, but the community partners are filling each other's needs without extra funding. So
right.
It's already been institutionalized in a particular way there.
Right. And so that's, you know, one of the ways you do this is you don't go and, you know, commit resources and expect the institutions to pick them up. But you sort of create it by everybody pitching in and doing their part. But when you have extra resources and you want to be able to do something, then institutionalization is an interesting possibility. And we'll talk much more about that in a few minutes. Great. So let's go on to the next one. You're getting the hang of this, and so am I. Our team must always be around in the future if our community is to achieve our agenda. Where are the votes on that? Strongly agree, agree, disagree?
So we have...
How critical are we to this, making sure that our agenda is achieved? Will domestic violence stay in the forefront of your community if you're not around?
Well,
okay.
About two-thirds who are in disagreement with that.
Right. So let's hear it. Again, you guys are getting the hang of this. Why did you say what you said? And I'm now realizing since we're recording this, we should be reading them so people who see a tape of this session will get to know what people actually wrote. Is that right?
Right. So the recording will actually have the writing, but it's also good to read it.
Okay. Got it. So our team must always be around in the future for our communities to achieve our agenda. Is that a piece of grandiosity or is that actually reality? I put agree because the program we are running does not financially depend on us. We coordinate things, but the community partners are filling each other's needs without extra funding. Oh, that was the early one. This is Deborah. If we got it right, wouldn't be necessary, but I think we're a ways from that. Yeah, I mean, we often hear people saying, you know, our job is to put ourselves out of business. And I think that's it's very altruistic, but I'm not so sure how realistic it is. So how critical are we to be the catalyst for the community changes we want to see on domestic violence? If we plan sustainability, the community would own it, but we're not there. Right? So one way to think about it is if you can do the sustainability and the institutionalization, they'll own it and you won't need to be there.
Well, Katya said we are the content experts and others don't feel like they can provide the same leadership and continuity.
That's right. So is it that your expertise may be what's needed?
Right.
And Jesse says, I think there needs to be some form of organized DV prevention, but it could vary depending on who is able to responsibility and coordination could change depending on the community context readiness. You want to do this one, Neil?
Sure. And from Sarah, at this point, our program is fairly sustainable, but our agenda is more than just one program, and we are still not in a position where it is possible for the agenda to be achieved without us.
Right. Got it. That's great. And, I think that one of the key roles for coalitions in communities is to be the catalysts for change. And so, you know, I think we saw it in tobacco coalitions. If you watch them, they did a very good job of putting champions for smoking cessation in a lot of the institutions in the community. And when their money disappeared, you know, the legislators discovered these tobacco coalitions got a huge amount of money from the lawsuit. And then the state legislators discovered it took about 3 or 4 years how to steal the money back. And so then all of a sudden they didn't have the money. But they had created with the money leaders in health departments, in business corporations, in chambers of commerce, in schools, so that many of the institutions really owned it and actually in many cases owned the content as well. So we have to look around to see who's successfully done it and where have we seen coalitions that there's just constant dependence on the coalition being there for the message to get through. So let me talk a little bit about some of the myths of sustainability. You did great on that. And I think we're getting the hang of this feedback thing on the computer. The first myth is that sustainability is best thought about in the waning months of your funding. And, in fact, that is what happens 90% of the time. I'm really thrilled that you guys could, in your present work, are building sustainability in. It really shows a great deal of wisdom and forethought to do that, and it's often very hard. When I go often to talk about coalition building to a new initiative that's launching, and I try to get people who are, you know, hiring staff and building their coalitions to start to think about sustainability, they don't have the patience for it. The next slide is another myth.
Just want to note that Katia raised her hand. So
oh, I'm sorry. Let's go back.
That might mean that's a question. So, Katia, press star one so we can hear your
And
hand.
How do I see that she raised her hand?
Can you hear us now?
Yes, we can.
Excellent. Great. This is actually Allison Smith. I'm the director of the program here. In regard to your last two questions about sustainability and community partners, we've been working through the Delta Project, you know, for many years to really try to create meaningful leadership within our community. But as Katia commented, you know, we're really seen as the content experts, and so other agencies and individuals really aren't willing to step up and take those leadership roles because they look at us and say, well, we could never do it as well as you could. The other thing that I think is challenging for us is we're in a very, very rural community, and, you know, our human resources are just limited.
Well, let me ask about the first piece you raised. How realistic is it that the content couldn't be picked up by the folks in the community? Is that true?
Well, it just hasn't been yet. I mean, they look to us for the leadership to keep it moving. You know, we also have the funding. We have the national, you know, partnerships through the CDC project. You know, I just think there's a feeling, well, why would we want to pick this up and lead it
right.
when your
right.
organization is doing it?
Right. And I guess then the question is, you know, how do we systematically think that through and show people that there's a way in which they can become the leaders on this. Certainly, I mean, if it was highly technical medical material, maybe, you know, it would take some more very, very technical training. But in most cases, it's not that complex cognitively. It's really a question of, I think, a very long-standing relationship that Health and Human Services, even prevention people, have built with communities where they see us as doing for them as opposed to doing with them. And so then we have to sort of systematically think, even though that's not our intent, is there any way in which we're communicating that message as opposed to communicating the message, you can do this? So there are people who, you know, pair up with a community person to do presentations and increasingly pass responsibility on to community members to see, you know, how much you can do. Now, of course, in a rural area, you may have fewer people, although I've done a lot of this work, and all you need is a couple who want to come forth and be the champions. But it's a good set of questions. Ready to move on, or anybody else going to comment?
Okay.
So the next slide, it says, everything we do must be sustained. And that's generally what we think about, which is, you know, what sustainability means that I've got a staff of three staff people and a $150,000 budget, and we do a newsletter and an annual meeting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when you ask me about sustainability, it means I want to do next year what I did this year with the same number of resources. And I think the issue of sustainability really needs to be challenged in sort of thinking about, well, what are we doing that works, that needs to be sustained, and what are we doing that doesn't? And certainly, you know, we've seen this phenomena, and the legislators always love this one, you know, of, you know, the balloons that say don't smoke and don't drink and don't do drugs. And the question is, what's the validity of all these balloons being passed out and how much? And I just use that as an extreme example, but we really have to take a careful look, and I'll talk about it in the planning process, about what do we need to sustain and what could be sustained by other people, or maybe what we're doing isn't being effective, and we need to think about letting it go.
Right.
Any comment on that? Great. So let's move on. It's all about finding the money, and we've already stated that. I think that one of the real problems with this concept is that, A, there's no money, and there's less and less money available as everybody is broke, cities, state, counties, the feds. But it also, if we set it up this way, and usually when you look at a lot of resources and you type in sustainability, it's all about writing grants, fee for service, how do you find the dollars. It limits our capacity to succeed, and it limits our understanding. You know, finding all the money is really going back to the myth before this, which is that everything we do is equally worthwhile. And as, you know, Allison pointed out, it's only things that we can do, the community can't do them, and therefore we have to just find the money to continue it. And I think that limits our capacity to succeed, and it limits the kinds of modalities we can use to try to get to sustainability.
And Sarah added that being broke actually encourages creativity.
That's right. Absolutely. And being broke encourages partnerships. So that's the other piece of it, which is, you know, how do we find other people to do this with? I know we were trying to do some child sexual assault prevention in a rural area, and we found a really good curriculum and someone who was willing to teach it and was skilled at it. We went to the superintendent of schools, and he said, I'm sorry, we have no money for this. We went to the superintendent of schools next door, and they said, yeah, we'll fund it. And then we had someone from a business association. It wasn't the chamber, but a group like that. It was, I think, the Lions or the Elks. And they were going to do an art auction. And they were wondering if they could commit the money that they got from that to child sexual assault prevention. And we said, oh, we'd love it. So this guy who I think ran an insurance company, you know, ran this auction, came up with this money. And at our annual meeting, he came and presented us with a check for, I don't know, $3,000, which was the exact amount we needed to cover the training, at which point we called the superintendent of schools up from the school that said, we would love to do this, but we don't have the money, even though that's not really what he meant. And we said, and we are so delighted to be able to turn this check right over to the school system so they can move forward on this curriculum. And, in fact, it happened. But, you know, if you start to think about, you know, where are the sources of dollars and resources and who else can be providing them, and you start thinking beyond money, it can be great. Okay. One more myth. Communities have the money to fund and sustain all pilot projects that show themselves to be effective and of value to the community. This is the pilot project myth, and I think we've all been there, where someone has given us money on a pilot project, and the assumption is that at the end of the pilot project, we're going to find the money locally to do this. Now, who gives us the money? Well, the money comes from the feds or a big foundation. And where do they expect us to get it? Well, who is working? Allison's working in very rural areas or, you know, parts of Montana, that somehow you're going to go to your town government, and they're going to have that little golden pot at the end of the rainbow that you see in the right-hand corner, and they're going to say, oh, you wanted some money from our successful pilot project fund. Sure, we can give you a couple $100,000. Well, in fact, when you're turning to local government, the people who have the least amount of money. And so it's a very complicated thing to do something successfully and be able to find local dollars to replace it. I've done it, and it really has been, it has not been brilliance. It has been pure luck. We developed, with the support of a foundation, a wonderful grassroots child abuse prevention program. And just as we were coming to the end of our 4 years, the state of Massachusetts started to do family preservation programming based on federal dollars, and we were in such a good position we could just apply for that, have gotten it, and it sustained us for, I think, the last 8 years to continuing to do that work. But that was not brilliance, that was luck.
Yeah, and Sarah has pointed out that communities barely have the money to pay for municipal services.
Right. And I think that's absolutely right, but the concept of pilot projects, often they're really talking about finding, you know, they ask you annually, how are you doing at finding the local replacement dollars? And we all feel bad, and we run around, and we do in-kind. We show them all the in-kind we have. But I think it's one of the myths of sustainability. And so I think we're much better off thinking about how do we sustain the kind of efforts we're doing than to try to find the money locally. So let's talk.
Yeah. Tom, Julie, yeah. Is asking, are you defining communities as government entities?
No, it's not just governments. It can be local foundations. It can be local United Ways. There are lots of places you can turn. And unless you're from a big, rich community, most of them do not have the kind of dollars to replace it. But it's a good question. Government is only one piece of it. But it's, you know, any kind of local resources you would have. But they really, the pilot concept is we who have all the big money, the feds and the foundations, are turning to you. We're going to give you this to pilot it. And then you're going to find local money, government, non-government, volunteer to replace our dollars. And I think that that's not a good understanding of where money is in this country. Does that make sense? Okay. So let's go on and talk about the kind of outcomes. When we're talking about sustaining, the question is, what are we going to try to sustain? So it's activities, relationships, and functions, as I just talk about it. So the first thing is the activities. And these are practices you've started, strategies you've started, policies you've started, and changes in community norms. There's some research work out of Kansas that says if you think about success in coalitions, it's usually changes in programs, policies, and practices, which is what we're able to create, that then ultimately lead to the changes in the community indicators. And so those are some of the kinds of things that we create that are worth sustaining. That makes sense? Anybody? Julie says... Yes, I mean, can't be to that question. So, so let's go on to the next slide. The other thing that we're trying to sustain are the relationships and partnerships, and someone was talking about that, which is, would these folks still come together when we meet? You know, one of the important outcomes is that people start to make links with each other, and even with people they've had a relationship in the past, those relationships start to change. So, we used to have a coalition that insisted they could only meet 1 hour a month. That was it. People were trying to go for an hour and a half. Absolutely not. We're too busy. And then we would go there and watch what happened. At the end of the hour, they would all go into the stairwell, and as opposed to walk out of the building, they'd spend half an hour in the stairwell talking with each other. And we listened to what's going on in that stairwell because we thought, well, they have more time. They were doing the important work of the community in that stairwell. They were talking about what's new at their place. And they were talking about, you know, things that they might do together, a grant they could write with each other, referrals from one person to another of clients or programs or opportunities. And so the work you do on building relationships is really fundamental. So you have kind of the activities, practices you want to sustain. And if you would disappear, the question is, who would bring the people in the community who care about domestic violence together on a regular basis so they could keep things moving? Who would keep the providers of service with the cops and the courts all together talking on these critical issues?
I think the point that you raised about being able to recognize where productivity is, like in the stairwell, nobody would have necessarily identified that as the place where some of the most important things happen, but in fact, on the ground, that's where the relationships are being developed and sustained. People are, you know, actually doing the work of building the network.
Absolutely. When I've done coalition evaluations, the one reliable question you can ask and always get really high scores on is, have you built relationships with other organizations that are helpful in terms of getting your work done? And people always say, absolutely, that's the best thing about the coalition. So, yep. And then finally, there's the functions of the collaborative team. So it's one is the activities, one is the relationship. But you are the catalyst. And as a catalyst, you are the gatherer convener. You bring people together to come up with brand new solutions to programs, and you are the monitoring of the collaborative activities. So you're the group that can say, you know, it's not useful to open up another domestic violence shelter in the county. We already have one. What are you doing that for? But if you're not there as the convener of a group that takes some oversight in looking at the issue, then that kind of dysfunctional competitive behavior can break out in our work. So that kind of internal coalition function is really critical, and we don't often think about that. We think, well, we need to maintain our staff, we need to maintain our programs, but it's this catalyst function that may be the most critical thing. I mean, often, you know, I think, boy, if we could just sustain that piece, even if we have to cut our programs because our dollars disappear, that piece has a great function, and I think that was the issue of, you know, do we have to be around all the time in the future? Okay? So in order to do this work, you know, we have to, if we're going to sustain our work, we have to sort of say, well, where is it that we want to be going? What is it that we want things to look like in a couple of years? And one way to do that, and this is a visioning exercise that really is very easy, and now I should announce that you have not only the PowerPoints, but you also got sent to you some handouts. And so this visioning exercise in its full-blown place with instructions is available in the handout, and you could use that with your team back home or any of your teams or coalitions you're working with. But for our purpose, we're going to do it real briefly here. And we just ask you to think, if 2 years from now, your local newspaper has decided to write a feature story on your accomplishments and work, what does the article say? Write a headline for the article and put that in the chat box. Okay? So take a minute, take 30 seconds, a minute, just to say, okay, no one ever lets you write your own headline. What's your headline going to say? I'm going to be quiet so you can just think about it. And when you're ready, put it in the chat box.
Sarah, who has written her headline, Cranston Unites to Prevent Violence.
There we go. Anybody else ready to put a headline down?
What the story is of our work.
Right.
And that forces, you know, headline forces you to, that's kind of like Twitter forces you to do it quickly. Oh, now people are coming in.
New counties adopt violence prevention programming. Southwest Detroit youth work to end dating violence. So you're communicating in the first headline this issue of unites. So you're talking about we got people to come together. And in the second, you're really talking about the counties adopting. So this is really the institutionalization. And in the third headline, you're really talking about those most affected by the issue taking the ownership and being the ones who are working to create the peace to end the violence. They're all great, great visions and great images that have a lot to do with sustainability, because you have to think about what are we going to do to get to that place? Anybody else want to add one before we move on? Here comes one. Kansas governor commits to primary prevention of, okay, so what's that commitment? And who is the Kansas governor today after Sebelius? Great. All right, so that gives you some sense. Now, this is a great exercise to do with coalitions. I remember doing it in Rockford, Illinois, where there were 5 different violence prevention coalitions. And everybody said, oh, we're in total disagreement about everything with each other. And we came together and we did this exercise. And the exercise itself, you don't just write the headline, but you write down 5 bullets as well. And what we discovered was we actually do share in common where we're headed. And I think vision is really important in terms of driving us forward so we get where we're going to go. I mean, these headlines that you wrote all sound like they're the same, you know, ice cream and apple pie. But in fact, each of them requires a different way of thinking about how you're going to move forward. You know, Sarah means uniting people. Katja talks about getting the counties to own it. Jesse adds getting the youth to own it, and Deborah adds getting the governor to own it and acknowledge it. And so those all would drive your behavior in and your activities in one direction or another. Let's move to the next slide.
Before we do that, I also want to just add that I think it's important for us to retrain the media on how to report things that actually strengthen the prevention effort, because we so often read about the tragedies, right? But how often do we read about the prevention efforts, and how often is it a headline? I mean, you know, it's just really rare. So I appreciate the exercise, Tom.
Yeah, well, and of course, we never get to write our headline, do we? So it's nice to do that. But, yes, and it requires quite a bit of work. You know, domestic violence murder is headline news. A good relationship with the police that leads to, you know, restraints and that leads to, you know, curriculum in the school about dating violence and that kind of stuff is really hard to get going. But there are people, there's more and more of it. Every time you see a story in the paper, think about how they manage that. That's usually they got some kid to talk about it, and so they make it very personal. Great. Let's move on. I'm going to give you an example of both vision and then really pushing it. The Institute for Community Peace out of Washington has done wonderful work on violence prevention, and I'll show you their model of the stages in a second. But they did the exercise of trying to say, what would be the long-term legacy, even beyond 2 years? And they said it's the ongoing process to maintain transformation of a geographic community from one that suffers from and reacts to violence to one that prevents violence in all its forms and supports lasting peace. And when we first started the work with them, and I was a consultant to them, there were 10 sites across the country, and it was all community violence prevention work. And the group in New Orleans renamed themselves the Crescent City Peace Alliance. And it was really interesting because they just took the word violence right out of their name, and they were the Peace Alliance. And so what this really says is if you're really going to talk about what's the vision, what's the transformation to be, it's not that you're going to spend the rest of your time talking about we got better resources for women who are victims of domestic violence, survivors of domestic violence. What instead you're going to be talking about is how we've changed gender roles in our community and we are now finding that there's lasting peace in intimate relations. You know, that's a mighty big vision, but it's interesting in terms of having it drive us in a different kind of way.
Exactly.
The vision is, I think, a helpful process.
Absolutely.
So let's move on. The same group, the Institute for Community Peace, talks about the stages that they see in communities addressing violence. And they say the first thing you have to do is create safety, and that's clearly a priority in a lot of the domestic violence work. We then have to understand violence and its root causes, not just in terms of gender roles, but also in terms of the social determinants of peace, economic issues, education issues, the whole range of employment issues. You know, what's going on in the community? We need to build community around this, and your headlines are a lot about building community. And you need to be promoting peace, not just preventing violence, so that the ultimate is we're building democracy and social justice in communities. And when we've done that, then, you know, it's quite a transformation in terms of thinking about violence prevention. I now do some work on health disparities with the Boston Public Health Commission, and the office that I work for is the Office of Health Equity and Social Justice. And they're understanding that you just got to build the social justice component right in from the beginning. Does that make sense? Let's move forward. So let's go through the sustainability planning process. There are a number of slides here, but most of it is the same strategic planning process you use for other things. It's the ending that's a little bit different. You start with your core building blocks, your goal, your vision, your mission. You develop a shared understanding of sustainability, and that really requires doing a visioning process, this visioning exercise or anything else. You know, we often talk about coalitions being groups of people with a common interest who work together for a common cause. But in fact, if you haven't done a visioning exercise, it's not so clear that everybody has a common cause or a common agenda. They come together because they're all interested in the issue, but they haven't gone through that process. Or they got a grant that three agencies wrote, and all the other people in the room are going along with the vision that came out of that grant, but they haven't been part of forming it. Then we assess what we're doing now and what do we want to sustain. So let's go to the next slide to take a look at that. You know, you take an inventory of your present programs, and then you decide on the criteria for sustainability. And these don't have to be your criteria, but these are some of the ones you could use. Is, you know, are you having impact? Is it working? You know, you may have a program that you feel is, you know, we've been doing this counseling education program for the men who are involved in domestic violence, and we obviously have to keep doing it, even though if you look at the results, it hasn't had any effect. Costs and benefits, you know, are we getting our bang for our buck? Is there still a need? Have we done something in such a way that, you know, that high school is no longer experiencing this problem, so we don't need to be there? And sustainability really requires asking the question, is there strong community support? You know, if we've been doing something for 5 or 10 years, and we may think it's important, and the community still hasn't bought it, then we have to really think about, well, what's that about? Why haven't we been able to get this community to come around? And then is there potential funding? And so you can take a look at the inventory of present programs and ask these questions to decide whether you are going to try to sustain that part of your program. Are there other questions you would add to the criteria piece? Difficult to measure success, as many of the outcomes are longer-term generational. Well, I think that's right. And so that's the trouble in doing prevention work. That's why I like the evaluation system. And at the end, you'll see a slide that talks about the Community Toolbox, which is a website that has a lot of material on it. And you can, they also have their documentation system for coalitions on there. And there you can ask the question, are you changing programs, policies, and practices that someone else has done the research on that says, if you, this curriculum, when done with junior high school boys and girls, finds a reduction in violence between dating violence in high school. And if you know that that's the case, you don't have to do that research again to prove it. Your outcome is that you've implemented that program and it's become the practice of that high school, junior high school, to do that curriculum. And sometimes we haven't seen the research on it, but I think we can look to see what has been researched. We don't have to do the research on every one of our interventions. That's a demand that's outrageous for us. But I think we can be looking to see hasn't been done before. But it's a good question. It doesn't, but that doesn't mean it's working. Well, I think it can be, we usually have an on-the-ground sense about whether things are working or not. But I think if there's research that shows that doing smoking stings, where you set up youth to go into convenience stores and buy cigarettes, and if they sell them to underage kids, you bring in the health department who gives them a fine. The research on that is that, A, it gets convenience stores to comply, and, B, it does cut down on youth smoking. You don't have to show that research in your community. You can implement that program, document that you've done it, and have some hope that the research will apply to your community as well. That may be as close as we're getting to working. But usually on the ground, we also have a sense about whether it's working. And so it's a good question. I don't know if what I said answers it or not, but it's a good question.
Ready to move on?
Yes. So let's talk about the four approaches to sustainability. And I talk about them as institutionalization, which is, getting the program you're working on absorbed in some part of the community, policy change, community ownership, changing community norms, and finding the resources. So this expands our thinking to four ways of doing this. And now let's go through each of the four. And then, of course, back in the sustainability planning process, we go into implementation. So let's move forward. Keep going to the next one. Forward, yeah. Those are the four approaches. Let's go forward one more. On the issue of institutionalization, and you'll see you now have a worksheet for that and questions in front of you. Institutionalization involves partnering with agencies to maximize the chance of successfully transferring ownership. So that when you have a 3-year grant and you run the curriculum in the schools for 3 years, and then at the end of the 3 years you go to the schools and say, take it on, your chances of success really get reduced. But if you say, we're going to do a school curriculum, we have a 3-year grant, let's bring them in as partners, we'll do the work in the beginning, in the second year we'll train their teachers, in the third year they'll do it on their own, and we'll be working with them and the school committee to find funding to support it, then you are systematically planning for institutionalization. And I think we don't often do that. But you can start to ask yourself, what are the things that we do already that you presently hope could be institutionalized? Or if you start to go through them, you could say, this could go somewhere. And then you start to think around, who in the community could adopt this? Now, if you've already been successful at that, that'd be great. So let's hear from you in terms of where have you been successful in getting something you've done this year, past years, adopted by a local institution. It can be the police, it can be the schools, it can be protocols, it can be strategies, it can be the way the courts operate, it can be the way the high school, you know, deals with issues. And if you haven't done it already, what else is on your plate that you're doing that you would like to see institutionalized, and who do you think could adopt them? Okay.
So we want to invite you to use your text chat to give us a response to that question. What strategies and programs have you already or do you hope to institutionalize?
And if I'm not being clear about institutionalization, just ask questions. So Sarah comes in. We have a local university, I'll go back up to find follow it, providing volunteers to provide a mentoring program to youth at the local teen center. The college students are all trained and need the credit, and the teen center needs people to work with the kids. So that sounds like, Sarah, that's already been institutionalized. Great, great example. Wisconsin Teen Summit on Dating and Sexual Violence started as a collaboration among several organizations. And I guess the question is that continuing? And are you successful in getting the various components to be putting in the dollars to keep that summit going? And that would be institutionalizing it. And I think that's right. Sometimes between agencies, when we make a joint effort to keep doing something, that's an example. Katya says, we're trying to train teachers, but the time it takes to train them, the time they have to implement curriculum, is very limited. Also, because of where we are, the high turnover teachers makes it difficult to sustain a group of educators that can deliver instruction. There certainly are barriers to making that happen. It's not just formally training teachers, but getting their knowledge attitudes up to our standards is challenging. Now, that's a really interesting issue because I think so much of our work is trying to change people's attitudes and values and ways of setting community norms, whether it's the teachers in the school or the kids at the school. And how do you do that? And one of the discouraging pieces is after you've done it, it needs to be done again because you've got new populations coming in all the time. So I think that's right. Are there some things that you're working on now where you'd like to get something institutionalized, and what kind of target might you have in mind to adopt it? Okay, let's go on to the next question. They pop up with answers. And so that's the question, how do you engage them? But the other piece of this is if you spin off the programs, what are the implications for the collaborative? And that's an interesting process. If you flip forward two or three to the one that says coalition task force process. Yeah. You know, what we usually do when we have a task force working on issues is we identify the stakeholders, we investigate, we define the problem, investigate the options, design a response, evaluate, adapt, and implement the plan, get the resources to keep it going. What this coalition did was they added another step to it, which was to spin it off. That from the beginning, as they think about their coalition task forces, they give them this kind of step-by-step process, and they indicate to them the ultimate goal is to spin the program off. Now, a lot of coalitions develop programs and hang on to them. And so it's the domestic violence coalition of such and such a county, and they have this educator program, and they have this intervention program, and they run the shelter, but the spinning off is where you get to the concept of sustainability. Now, if your executive director says, I want to see you grow an empire and want you to have more and more programs, then spinning it off is counter to that. And in fact, in the human service and health and human service business, empire building is the norm. So spinning off is really quite a radically different way of thinking about it. But I'm suggesting that if you're going to be successful in institutionalization, you adopt this. There's an article about it where the woman, B.L. Hathaway, who worked with me on the Lower Outer Cape Community Coalition, talks about that process and the example of spinning off a low-income dental health clinic as a way of operating. If you're going to do this kind of work, then you got to be in the position to have a strong coalition that really is committed to enhancing each other's capacity. And here, let's take a look at the coalition, the continuum of collaboration. I'll go through this quickly so we can get to the other three. But in the continuum of collaboration developed by Arthur Himmelman, who's up in Minnesota near Wisconsin, there are four things that happen in coalitions. The first is networking. Go to the next slide. Where we are exchanging information for mutual benefit. We do this in coalitions all the time. We give each other information. We change business cards. We tell people, give them a flyer for what's happening in our effort. These four stages, these four functions, all build on each other and get more complex, and they get more risky. And the next one is coordination, exchanging information, modifying activities for mutual benefit. You have a couple of domestic violence programs who meet on a regular basis. Someone says, I'm going to do a big fair at the high school next Thursday afternoon. And someone else says, but I was going to do mine then. And because they're going to do coordination, they say, well, I'll move mine till next month. We did this in a rural community about feeding hungry people hot meals, and we had brought the churches together. We said, who feeds the homeless with warm meals? And when two churches raised their hand, and we said, well, when do you do it? The first church, and they said, Sunday. We turned to the second church, and you, and they looked a little sheepish, and they said, Sunday. Small community, 6,000 people, five churches, and they were serving the meal on the same day. Because they were churches, they agreed to move one of them to Wednesday. So that's, modifying your activities. And then the next is cooperation, where you're doing all of the above, but now you're going to share resources. And as soon as you start talking about resources in a coalition, then everybody sort of gets more antsy. They grab their wallet. They think, not my resources. And so here we got to talk about, what does that mean? Well, the reason we come together in coalitions is to do together that which we can't do apart. Otherwise, why would we do this? And so very often we don't have the resources to do something that needs to happen. But if we pool resources, we can. Simple example and a cheap example is the Cambodian community is going to hold a health fair. It's $75 to rent a table. Three agencies throw in $25 apiece and they share the table and put their information down together. More complicated example. Springfield, Massachusetts wanted to create door-to-door health promotion visits in the Latino community. Three agencies each had a third of an outreach worker. They pooled their money so they'd have one full-time worker who then went and talked about HIV, which was one person's grant, substance abuse prevention, which was another, and violence prevention, which was the third. And one agency had the worker, and if I was the agency that had the HIV money and I gave it to the agency that had the violence prevention money, I had to count on the fact that when they knocked on the door, they would talk about all three efforts. It has some more risk to it, but if I didn't pool my money, no doors would get knocked on. Because when we have a third of an outreach worker, we don't knock on a third of the doors. We just don't do it. We sit and we set up a booth somewhere or a table. So really critical, and I'm going to ask you in a minute to think about, which of these you do in your coalitions. But finally, if you're going to really look at institutionalization, you've got to go to collaboration. And here the phrase in the middle, you can underline it, is enhancing the capacity of another for mutual benefit. That's the real key. Here, the two groups are going to work together. When the police and the shelter work together, the police are trying to make the shelter the best it can be, and the shelter is trying to make the police the best it can be. When a hospital and neighborhood work together, it can be that. The hospital can also be working together in the low-income neighborhood as a charity. It's not mutual. It's not enhancing the capacity. But when the hospital understands that this low-income neighborhood can increase their capacity to be responsive and effective in the Latino community, and the Latino community can understand that the hospital can help them have a healthier population, then it's mutual. So in your coalitions, you want to drive the behavior away from just networking and building towards coordination, cooperation, collaboration, because the further you go down that, the more you're going to be able to make the kind of changes that will lead to institutionalization. Does that make some sense? And if so, can you think about an example where you've done any one of these that's been especially effective in your coalitions? Networking, coordination, cooperation, collaboration. Clearly, my bias is to say that the more significant changes we want to create in the community are where we can enhance the capacity of the other, where we've really moved to collaboration. It is, in fact, I think, a revolutionary concept, and mainly doing the other things before that. Can you think of examples where you've been able to do that, or cooperation? You want to chat that in? Nope. Are you still awake? Still there? Here we go. I think we're at the cooperation. Okay, this is great. Thank you.
It takes time for people to type.
Yeah, I know. I have to get used to this. I'm a process person, so I'm looking around the room here.
Right. So Sarah says, I think we are at the cooperation stage. The resources, in quotes, we are sharing are mostly physical, like meeting space.
Okay, but that's the beginning.
And Julia says that offering facilitation training to Governor's Council on Domestic Abuse Committee members is the way that they're collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
And Katya says, we're working with schools to promote a healthy school environment, which is mutually beneficial.
Right. And, again, you can work in the schools to do that, and it can be either mutually beneficial, or it can be, oh, we're letting those people in to do their thing. But when the school begins to understand what's going for them, and you say we promote schools' good actions in local media, and they start to get something out of it, then you're really building that mutuality. Again, offering facilitation training to the Governor's Council, when that council says, oh, that was terrific, let's see if we can support your work, it starts to become that kind of collaborative exchange. So this is a very helpful, you'll see there's a worksheet in here on that. I think there is. And if not, there's some on my website on this, where you can go to your coalition and ask, which of these are we doing? Because the more you push towards the collaboration end of the continuum, the greater chance you have of making those big changes. So that's institutionalization. Let's move on to the next, which is policy. You know, here we're asking the question, you know, what policies, large or small policies, have you changed or do you hope to change that could help you get to your goals? Now, a large policy might be, you know, something that's a statewide funding policy for increasing dollars to domestic violence. It could be including domestic violence services in Medicaid reimbursements. It could be, you know, legal changes in the law about how the courts deal with domestic violence. Small policies can be how your local police department deals with its with a case of domestic violence. What does police do? What the local emergency room does when someone walks in? And these are, you know, and I would imagine you certainly have been involved in changing small policies a lot, and most likely in large policies. So, you know, when you think about what have you changed, and what do you hope to change around policies? And certainly if you've read the most recent writings of the new CDC director, Thomas Frieden, he has this triangle, which I think is being promulgated all across the country, and the bottom part of it is all about policy change. So this is the way we continue our work. The tobacco coalition's disappeared. The bans on smoking all through your community are still there. That's their sustainability. That was their legacy. So what policies are you thinking about? We're working with Break the Cycle to develop a model teen dating violence prevention school policy specifically relevant to rural areas. So there you go. That's going to be a small P policy that would be adopted by local schools unless it was adopted as a statewide mandate. We're trying to get the teen center to open their doors to some students who aren't enrolled there in order to attend our program. Okay, so you're going to modify the admissions policy at the teen center so that some of the kids you want to work with can get in there. Yep. These are kind of local policies. Are there larger policies that have big implications that you're working on or you know other states have worked on that have big implications for reducing domestic violence, family violence, child abuse? Are there some that you're working on now that are kind of capital P policies? anybody, okay, so in order to do policy changes, let's move forward a couple of slides, we have to become sophisticated about creating policy change. Now, in small policies, it's not such a big issue because it's really, oh, here we go, Rhode Island and other states have pushed legislation through on teen dating violence. There you go. Our state coalition is working to pass legislation on child custody and visitation in cases of domestic violence, right? So those are the bigger piece, exactly. So those are two good examples. If you want to push legislation through, then you have to get sophisticated in how does policy change. And that means, you know, a lot of us who are doing this work and have been around for a while, we know how to pick up the phone and call our legislators, and we know how to set up visits with them in their offices. But what really is interesting is to sort of take the people from the community who are working with you, the survivors and others and the kids who've gone through programs who are excited by this, and give them some training on how do you do education of legislators. I mean, I did a program for years around health access where we met with people who were trying to enroll the uninsured, and we were always talking about policy changes that needed to be made in order to increase access. And we brought in the statewide health advocacy group every month into these meetings. And we would say, now you have to call this person and tell them that this is what we need to do. And after 2 or 3 months of, maybe 6 months of doing this, I looked around the room and I said, who made calls last time? And there were 30 people in the room, but only 4 hands went up. And I said, how many of you have ever called your state legislator? And very few had. And I was totally baffled because these are just bright, smart advocates. They're really tough and they're committed to their issue. So the next time we got together, we did a role play where we pretended we were calling our state legislator, and everybody got to practice with the partner who they paired up with. And I explained to them that when they call their state legislator in Massachusetts, they're going to, the phone's going to be answered by an 18 or 19-year-old college kid who's interning for the legislators because they don't have any budgets. And they're not going to have to worry about talking to some hotshot politician because they never pick up the phone. And they didn't have to be too scared. And the next time we got together and we asked people how many made the call, then we got more than half the room saying they'd actually done it. So we have to be purposeful in building our capacity to change policy if one of the things we're wanting to do is change policy. And we often do that at the top of our organization, the statewide domestic violence organization. We'll, you know, make sure that the heads of the local agencies are pretty well trained and know how to do this. But I'm suggesting we also bring it down a level and do this with our local people as well.
So I want to say, Tom, that we're at about 11:15.
Got it.
Okay.
To demonstrate the benefits of prevention program to lenders are sold on the idea. Okay, so let's move on to the next. Third is community ownership, which is what community norms do you wish to change? So let's get a response to that. What are the norms you're trying to change in your community? Because that's one way we get sustainability. We change norms in terms of how people in the community operate, and it's much more common in our work than we usually acknowledge. And we're not always as purposeful in thinking about it. But what norms are you trying to change? And, you know, so type those in. Condoning violence, respect equals promoting health. Respect equals promoting healthy relationships. Acceptance of violence, gender role, privacy issues. Acceptance of the traditional gender roles and levels of bystander intervention, speaking up against oppression. I think in your work, acceptance of violence among youth, I'm not so sure I understand what a number of people have now said this. Are we saying that we should, I don't think you're saying we should accept that it's normative for kids to be violent? Am I misunderstanding this?
Jessica, can you press star 1?
Because Katya also says acceptance of violence, and I'm not too sure.
Hello?
Hello? Phone's ringing.
Okay, so Sarah says that we want to accept.
Do other people hear the phone ringing?
I can hear it, Tom.
Okay.
David, are you there?
Okay, good. So we want to change the norm of acceptance of violence, right? That a lot of people, I mean, I live in Massachusetts, right very close to the South Hadley place where there was a bullying that led to a death that has just blown up the whole state and it's been covered nationally as well. And we're really trying to say that we want to change the norm so that violence is not accepted, that being a quiet bystander is not accepted and oppression is not accepted. Those are huge community norm changes. And I think, in fact, in your work, you do more conscious work at changing those norms than many do. And then the question is, you know, what do we have to do to change those norms? And how do you go about doing it? And so I think you're seeing that's a huge way. If you could write your legacy statement that said that in our high schools and junior high schools, the various groups of people, gender or whatever other separation occurs, deal with each other with respect, that there's no violence when things start to move towards violence, there is a community response instantly by the bystanders and the institution that says this is not the norm, then you in fact could start to put yourself out of business. But that's a huge community change in a culture that's as violent as ours and where the media loves violence as much as our world does. So you can now see that if you think about it this way, that's a big part of your sustainability is in the norm changes. And finally, let's move forward. We've done a little of that. Let's talk about the last category, which is finding resources to sustain the issues. And here, you know, there are a variety of techniques that you use: foundations, grants, fees, fee for services, seeking local government money. Those are all parts of getting the dollars. Let's go to the next slide, because I think the other piece is that I think is really critical is where you can turn to for in-kind resources for so much of what you need, because even though people may not have cash, if they really buy into what you're doing, then a lot of, you know, what you're needing can be gotten from that effort as well. So let's go to the closure here. So, oh, and then there's the, go back, I'm sorry. The question then becomes, the next one. You know, how can I take this material on sustainability back home? What's most relevant? What doesn't apply? And what are the questions? So let's use this last time minutes to talk about, well, does this help to think about it as a four-pronged approach? What are the challenges ahead of us? And how do we imagine translating this into sustaining our domestic violence work or the groups in our community who we support in doing this? And here Sarah says, our library has been invaluable as a resource there. Great, as an in-kind space resource. So, you know, this is a good time if you want to raise your hand and ask it as a question verbally, you want to type it in. You know, where does this leave you in terms of thinking about sustaining your efforts by thinking about it in a four-pronged approach as opposed to just where can you find the money? I think community ownership, capacity building is most relevant for our community. I think that's right. I think, Jessica says, and so much of the time we think about it as money, but it's mainly those kind of issues. And so then you have to ask yourself, what are we doing that's working towards that community ownership and capacity building? Sarah, my community partnership team is meeting in August to do some long-term planning, and I think this will help me keep them focused on sustainability. And absolutely, you know, it's a great time to do the vision exercise with them, even write a legacy statement together, and then use the worksheets on the four approaches, because what happens uniformly when people do this is they begin to think, oh, there's more ways of thinking about sustainability. And then you really can start to drive your efforts towards what, you know, Jesse is saying, which is community ownership and capacity building, as opposed to, you know, let's have every member of the board raise $2,000, because that's only part of what you really need to think about. So great, that can be useful. That's terrific. And again, there is a reference, if you hop forward a couple of slides.
Actually, we have Katya, who would like to have her line open.
Okay, great. Go to the next one. There's a one after that.
Sorry.
I was going to turn to the references, the websites. Well, there's my book, which is a reference, and then there's the Tools for Sustainability. This whole thing is written up as a tool in the Global Journal of Community Psychology Practice, free on the web, and the address is there. It's in the upper right-hand corner, and you can print out all the forms and PDF form quite neat and clean, and you can use them for that. You can go back towards the action planning sheet. Yes. Katya, you got it coming on? Is she coming on?
And you can press star 1. And please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Wow. We are having a hard time getting our line open. I think what is challenging for us in terms of translating what you've been talking about today, a couple of things. You know, you talked about spinning off. And you gave the example, I think, of dental clinics. But, you know, with dental clinics, there's still dentists running the operation. And so that's not as challenging a spinoff as, you know, because all those people are in the same field. It's harder to spin off to a non-teen dating violence organization when, again, we are seen as the community experts on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing that's challenging...
Well, can I ask you, what would you want to spin off?
Well, I'm just going off of your presentation about
right.
that being really gold standard to spin it off, to write ourselves out of a job. Maybe I misunderstood.
Well, I think if you're doing it on some pieces of it, yeah, I think the question, but you have to ask, it's not always appropriate. I mean, I don't think we would, in spinning off the dental clinic, we spun it off to a dental provider. We didn't spin it off to the local Lions Club.
Right.
And so the question really is, not everything it can be done that way, but it's a way of thinking that drives you there. So I guess the question would be, what are the kind of things you have on your plate that you might want to think about spinning off, and then how do we think about that?
And that's what's challenging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're not a state coalition, we're a local program.
Right.
So I could see a state coalition creating something and then spinning it off to the local programs. But when we're already at the local level, you know, and this gets back to, you know, building community leadership and a really high functioning coordinated community response team, we are still seen as the catalyst and the people who need to do this.
Well, I, you know, that goes back to that earlier slide about what do you sustain. I think that's right. I think you are the catalyst. But I think you could think about, you know, I wonder if our teen violence prevention program could be adopted by the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts and talk to their leaders. Or, you know, you could put out mini grants to see who's interested in playing on an individual issue and maybe lure them in to take a larger role. They may not take the catalyst role. But if you can think about what parts, that's why it's important to sort of break down the parts of what you do and think about what part could be adopted. Because the more parts that are adopted by the community, the more you get what Jesse talked about in terms of community ownership and capacity building going. So it may not be that everything you do can, but I'm asking what parts can you imagine? Now, most of the work I've done in coalitions involving spinoff has been in rural areas, populations of 8 or 10 towns that may have a total population of 30,000 people. So it's not always, you know, spinning it off to somebody large and professional, but the question is who shares our vision, our care? You know, when we spell out this vision of a county in our state where the gender roles do not involve violence, who else would care about that, who would want to help and adopt part of it? Does that help?
Yes, thanks.
And you had another part B to the question. Do you want to?
Oh, yeah, just a lot of the public health issues that, you know, we've been talking about today, things like drinking and smoking, they're more binary issues, either yes or no, you smoke or you don't smoke. And we have found that violence is much more challenging to work with because it's just not a simple black-white.
Absolutely. But I think increasingly with the view of public health issues as social determinants of health, then we're beginning to understand that all of this stuff is not as black and white. We're really having to take a look at the cultural context because health is determined by all those things. And, you know, when we did a grassroots child abuse prevention program in a rural community, then we really did, you know, part of it was doing leadership development for the moms whose kids used to be, in the hands of the Department of Social Services and getting them to be trained to be community leaders and to be faculty on the nurturing program, which gave parents skills to be able to make those changes and, you know, all kinds of issues like that understand that this is not, oh, we have those parents who beat their kids and then we have those parents who don't, but that it's a much more complicated issue and it's set in a context of, you know, the culture and what's accepted and what's challenged and what resources there are for people who are struggling. So I think you're absolutely right. But I would say there may be more opportunity in a rural area than you may be giving your community and you credit for. Any other final comments on how this could be helpful or questions you have before we end?
All right.
I leave with the picture of the Dalai Lama and be optimistic. It feels better, he says, and I hold that for this work as well. And then if you flip through just two more slides, back to the book. I have a new book out from Josie Bass. You can look at it, go to my website and see more information on it. That really lays out a lot of this coalition building stuff and six principles and lots of stories. A number of them are about violence prevention across the country and child abuse prevention. That may be a helpful resource. And my website and the Community Toolbox are two free web resources that also have tons of material that could be helpful.
Great.
This is an odd process, doing this without being able to hear you most of the time, but I really appreciate your participation and your comments because it really made it easier to be responsive to the issues.
Great. And I want to thank you, Tom, for bringing your presentation on sustainability. At this, we have a few more slides because this is the first in the series of four learning exchanges. And the four learning exchanges will actually, they're connected to pod sessions where folks will be able to take this material and discuss it in a small group. I've had a few responses from people who weren't able to sit in on the session, but they'll watch it and listen to it, and then they'll be signing up for pods as well. So we're going to move on and just take a minute to introduce Leah Aldrich, who is the pod facilitator. Leah, are you with us? If you press star 1, we should be able to hear you.
And no one has signaled.
Okay, so...
But as part of that pod process, later on in the summer, we're going to come back together, and you'll be able to come back to me and say, I tried this, and Tom, it sounds good, but it doesn't work, or I tried this, and it does work, or, right, we're going to have that chance.
Okay.
Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I can't trust, and they did just signal now.
Okay, great.
And their line has been open.
Okay, Leah?
Hi, everybody. I know nobody can hear me, but I mean, I know that people aren't able to respond. But I am pleased to be participating and to be able to facilitate the pod sessions. There are discussion sessions 1 and 2. And after we have been through the various discussion sessions, there will be a report back process later on in the summer that Tom just referenced. You can see there on the screen the schedule for when those discussion sessions will occur. And I'm really looking forward to kind of spending some time working through some nuts and bolts of many of the things that Tom covered in his presentation. So, for example, looking at things like how do we create more, specifically looking at some strategies for how do we get other people to own our issues, and that's going to require some collaboration, as Tom pointed out, so that may mean that we have to take on some of their issues. Where do we find nexus? Where do we, in an effort to build stronger, healthier communities, expand, you know, kind of philosophically or organizationally around these various issues? So I'm going to be looking forward to working more specifically around some of the nuts and bolts and some of the particular issues or characteristics of our individual communities around sustainability. So thank you.
Great. Great, Leah. Thanks so much. So, and on the slide in front of us, we can see that the POD meeting dates are there. I know that you all got those in the letter. So we just want to be clear that you are signing up for one POD, two meetings. So you sign up for one, pod one, pod two, or pod three, and the report out. David Lee has posted the sign-up. That will be also on the evaluation, that the follow-up email that you'll get shortly after the session. At this time, I want to ask David if there's anything else that we need to cover before we thank all of our participants and thank Tom Wolf again. I want to point out that you can applaud him in the same way that you raise your hand. Any questions? Then thank you very much for your participation, and we will see you in the pod sessions.
Bye, everybody.
And once again, that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.